Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO of Exchange Wire. And special guest here in the studio today is Steve Chester, Director of Media from ISPA. Welcome, Steve.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. Our pleasure. And, of course, with us from Exchange Wire, we have in the hot seat today Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content / Temporary Sound Guy.
Hi.
How's it going there, Lindsay?
I'm not sure yet. We'll see how the multitasking goes. Yeah. I haven't done this for a while. So
I think what we probably need to bring listeners up to speed on the Sound Guy arrangements.
Yeah,
because obviously we usually do. So we were trying to explain to Steve so that he realises this is a professional outfit. We do usually have professional sound guy. We've had Lindsay as stand-in sound guy before, worked really well. And then we had our commercial director, Anne-Marie Sheedy, as a temporary stand-in sound guy. Can't say not so good. That would be unfair. Let's just say the circumstances were challenging.
Challenging environment to record in, yeah.
We were out to Mexico. It was the morning after the night before. And, yeah, there was a few sound issues, weren't there? But anyway, that was a fun podcast. Everyone
nothing,
should tune into it.
Nothing to do with alcohol, though.
No, of course not. We're not big drinkers. Mm. No.
Yes, laughing far too heartily there. Okay, on to discussion of our first news story of the week. I wanted to chat with you guys about Snapchat's release of a new advertising tool, an advertising product called Dynamic Ads. And actually a bit of a general chat about Snapchat, because in addition to this article about their Dynamic Ads product, there was also news released yesterday about their user numbers, user figures, which have got Q3.
Yes,
of course. We're still in Q4.
We are.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Wow. It's October.
Yeah, we are.
This is London. I think I'm getting it. Anyway, their Q3 user numbers have kind of gone through the roof, right? So it's becoming a much more of a popular platform. Hmm. But I'll go into a bit more detail about that in a minute. The point about Dynamic Ads is that this is an automated tool which is enabling advertisers to produce ad creative formats, if you like, in real time, connected to a fairly extensive product catalogue. What I think is interesting about this is that it's another sort of suite in the tool chest that Snapchat are developing around their advertising offering. They're really going all in on this. There's also talk, particularly within this article and in general, that Snap are looking to target those challenger brands or DTC brands, digitally native brands that are perhaps struggling with interaction on Instagram. It's a significantly cheaper offering to Instagram ads, so therefore it's a kind of a different format as well. But you could see how for DTC brands and perhaps, you know, a sort of really new startup challenger brands that have got low budgets, this could be a really good way to kind of maximize their advertising reach. They also make some pretty bold claims about their audience, saying that they've got something like 90% of the 16 to 24 year old audience marketplace in the US, which feels to me
just sounds crazy.
I know. And
how huge, isn't it?
How do you, I'm not quite sure exactly how you find that 10% of young people in the US who aren't using Snapchat.
Why have you not got those? Is that the Amish population?
Well, exactly. It just seems quite astounding. So, you know, this is sort of an interesting move from Snap. And I think it also says something really interesting about that social media platform for DTC brands environment anyway. So I'm interested to hear what your perspective is, Steve, particularly from the sort of brand point of view.
Yeah, so I think it's welcome. I mean, it's, you know, dynamic creative optimization is, you know, is not new. I mean, clearly this is new. So I think particularly for retail, for travel, and emerging DTC brands, really, really interesting. And I think obviously the potential here to really drive better, stronger conversion, but also tempered with a need for balance, particularly around bombardment. You know, so the AI has done a lot of work around trust, around trying to understand what is it specifically that frustrates consumers? What are they, you know, what are they willing to accept? What frustrates them? And the AI did some really great research a few months ago, and the AA Council was working on a number of initiatives to try to address that. And bombardment's one of these issues. You know, an excessive frequency has been the bane, not solely of DC, of DCO, but it is a big factor. So it'd be interesting to see what sort of joined up strategy Snap will allow with that as well? So is it just completely walled off? How will they avoid excessive frequency? Will they allow managed frequency across their platforms to kind of avoid that sort of hammering, that sort of retargeting, which, you know, we all sort of love but also hate at the same time, particularly from a consumer point of view? So I'll be interested what sort of controls they put in place for this.
Yeah.
But it gives clearly that, you know, the ability for brands to test multiple creatives, you know, to test copied, to test, you know, creative examples which really work. But I just, you know, it does come with somewhat, you know, some baggage, I think. It just depends on how they actually implement it, I think.
Yeah.
So lots of promise there. The ability particularly to look at, as you said, a wide kind of product catalogue, and particularly interesting for those brands or, you know, those group of brands that have a huge portfolio.
Yeah.
You know, of different products, and the ability to be able to retarget that at scale in an efficient way.
Yeah.
But this isn't, you know, this isn't completely new. You know, I mean, those using, you know, Criteo, they use MyThings and, you know, and other similar products. This is, you know, this is a welcome extension. And as you said, perhaps the audience, again, and the ability to work with the younger audience, but that has to be balanced with, you know, observing ASA rules. And there are a number of sectors which clearly, you know, there's lots of sensitivity around, you know, about targeting them. So emerging
targeting a younger audience. Yeah.
Alcohol brands, gambling, we've got to make sure we don't, clearly. There's the ability of putting those, you know, ads in front of children.
It shouldn't be done so.
It needs to observe, you know, the ASA cap guidelines.
Yeah, yeah. Lindsay, what's your point of view here? A Snap, you know, like Steve says, this isn't sort of necessarily new, might be new for Snap. What are we going to see here in terms of opportunities for advertisers?
I agree with Steve that it's a good opportunity for Snap and for advertisers, mm-hmm. and it's a good opportunity for advertisers to be able to use the creative, the assets they've currently got in a different way on a different platform. And I would hope that the fact that Snap is an entirely logged in platform would mean the bombardment wouldn't necessarily be an issue because they can manage, hopefully, very well managed frequency capping. I think my concerns around it is I'm just not sure around Snap's user numbers. And also Snap's very, very strong on the fact that they've got this massive millennial audience. Instagram arguably has a much wider audience than just the millennial and Generation Z audience as well. They have an older audience. Like, you know, I know many people in my generation that are very, very active on Instagram, but don't have Snap accounts. Mm. And that, for example, is that generation too. And I'm of the old millennial generation that are a very, very attractive proposition for DTC brands because I am slightly older, I have money, and they're the people I'm trying to target. So Snap isn't necessarily the right target audience for them to be going after. And my other concern is there was a comment in the article that we referenced about the fact that advertisers that have tested it have said that it's 8 times cheaper than Instagram. Fantastic. Now, that's great for your procurement teams, but actually, does that mean that you are achieving the outcomes you want to? Yes, it's cheaper, but actually, what are your KPIs? And just because it's cheaper, does it mean that you're actually getting what you need from it? And also, if Snap does really well on this, and I believe it will do for certain types of retailers and e-commerce brands that are looking to target that millennial, the younger millennial audience, as the more competition, the more people that come onto the platform and start using it, you'll get to the same saturation problem that Instagram has.
Yeah.
Instagram is saturated because everyone's using it, because everyone's there. That's driving the price up.
Yeah.
The more advertisers that come onto Snap's platform, the price will drive up as well. So at the moment, CPCs or whatever, CPMs are quite cheap, but they're only going to increase as more and more people start using it. Yeah. So that's something that, get in while you can, I would say. Get in while you can and try and own the platform. And then when other people start coming on, you'll have had a really good head start.
Yeah, good share of voice there. And I mean, that's an interesting point. So, you know, it's something about the sophistication of the product. You know, how sophisticated will it be? What guidelines will it be adhering to? How exactly is it going to be offering those sort of opportunities for advertisers? And what will that feel like from an advertiser perspective using the product? And then there's the issue about, you know, is this an audience that advertisers necessarily want to be reaching? You know, that 16 to 24 age group, what's the purchasing power within that age group? It's certainly not the same as, like you say, the millennial and older millennial group. So is there really significant value in this for Snap, or is it just a sort of a race to, I don't want to say the bottom, but, you know, a race to expanding your user numbers as quickly as you possibly can? You know, I kind of also wonder if this is sort of being made a bit of a deal of from Snap's point of view at a time when we're starting to see a lot of controversy popping up around influencers and, you know, the ways in which those sort of influencer opportunities are maximized and the value that brands are getting out of that. Steve, do you have a point of view on that? Have you got, influencers are something that Instagram obviously – heavily promote. Are we seeing, is this just sort of an inevitable, the kind of controversy that's surrounding influencers at the moment, is this sort of an inevitable moment where people go, hang on a minute, can you actually prove that these influencers are really using these products, or that some of these influencers are actually even real influencers? Is that just an inevitable sort of, you know, a period in the kind of evolution of the world of influencers, or are we actually seeing some real pushback here from brands in terms of how influencers are being engaged?
I think a bit of both. I mean, it's clear that some brands in specific sectors works really well. So in the beauty sector, absolutely enormous, and it works really well with L'Oreal and other brands. You know, finding affinity, you know, with an audience they want to reach, and having influencers working with them in a really fruitful partnership has worked very well. I think there are clearly growing pains, a lot of growing pains in relation to influencers. We've seen very high profile issues like the Fyre Festival, which obviously went horribly wrong.
Yeah, I love that story so much.
Which doesn't need much in the way of elaboration, but fake followers, you know, and just trying to, and you know, and issues with labeling of content that you just highlighted as well. So, you know, people not using hashtag ad, and just, and again, you're uncertain about whether or not that individual is promoting a product because it's their own personal view, or they've been paid for it. There was a story that emerged a few days ago about an influencer actually saying the majority of their content they put out was actually paid for, but they didn't always indicate it. So those stories don't help. And I think some brands, and there was one brand we were speaking to a couple of weeks ago, I remember citing a specific issue with having to deal with, they were dealing with a talent agency, dealing with their influencer. And they were excited by the prospect of it. But because of the disconnect between working with the talent agency, because they have to work through the talent agent, who then in turn works with the influencer, there's very little in any kind of direct contact. And from my own personal point of view, how can that influencer understand the brand guidelines? Clearly the agency is going to understand the detail of that, and is going to read the, you know, is going to read the brand guidelines handbook and all that it entails. You don't necessarily would expect an influencer to, you know, to understand and observe that. But it's for the agency to do it. But clearly the influencer's got some really implicit understanding of what's suitable, what's not, what's the right tone of voice. And just throwing out ideas to the talent agency, who then just force those onto the clients, I think can sometimes create issues. And I think that particular brand was having some real challenges with, you know, with just A, the metrics and the provability of some of the metrics, but also just the disconnects. And we've seen that in the wider ad industry, haven't we? You know, we've got publishers now getting closer to buyers.
Yeah.
Still with the agencies partnerships, it's not, you know, trying to circumvent, but, you know, having a trusted selection and sort of sourcing of partners, of publishers, of ad tech partners, and actually having a wide, you know, everybody understands how you do business and what your tone of voice is, more to the point what the original client objectives are, rather than this sort of Chinese whispers of going from client through to whatever the publisher endpoint might be. And everybody clearly has got their own objectives, but completely misaligned potentially. And by the time it gets to the end products or the end, it just bears no relation.
Looks completely different to it, yeah.
And influencers, I think, is, you know, that I think it needs to develop. You know, we've developed two contracts for micro influencers and those for talent, for celebrity talents, and those with, you know, with large audiences. And it tries to give some direction around fake followers, fraud, trying to avoid that, about disclosure of commercial terms, and just trying to avoid, you know, sort of issues with labeling of content. So that was published, our updated contracts at the end of last year. So we give those to our members and brands to use in an advisory way. But there's no doubt that talent agents and agencies and clients and influencers have got, you know, there's some definitely some great
tidying up to be done.
Tidying up there to be done to make sure it's a fruitful relationship. But I don't, you know, own personal point of view, if you're taking money as an influencer, you really need to understand, you really need to understand, you know, the rationale for that and essentially what the objectives of the client are, rather than just saying it's my audience. And not that you're lucky to be associated with me, but I think there's a disconnect there. And some talent agencies, I don't think, are as good as they might be in terms of actually observing that and bridging the gap and making sure that clearly the brands, you know, brand guidelines and the brand's needs are understood, but still observing clearly and respecting the need of the creator and its audience and trying to find a way to gel the two. I think it's a bit clunky at times.
Well, I think because it became such a cottage industry so quickly, because everyone was like, oh my God, there's this massive industry and influencers. So it became for the agencies money for old rope. It was easy to do. And actually now there's more of a closer lens on influencers and what they're doing in their practices, and the way that the likes of platforms like Instagram are actually showcasing the fact that it is ad-supported content is changing this. And actually the agencies, I don't think, are ready for it. And there was some research done recently that said if you're kind of trying to keep up with the influencer lifestyle, they get so much stuff for free, and most of the stuff they get is free of charge, and they get 10% on holidays. You need to earn £1.2 million a year just to keep up with the average influencer that you're following. Mm. So actually there's going to be even more kind of from a social concern perspective, there's going to be even more eyes on the influencers and how they're promoting what they do. Mm. Because actually the majority of people they're trying to target, which is this 18 to 24 year old market,
they're not going to have that kind of live money their lifestyle. At their disposal.
And they're apparently getting into debt trying to. Oh, God, and that's going to be a concern soon.
Yeah.
So it feels like this isn't, you know, this is another area that's sort of on the cusp of sophistication, as it were. You know, it needs to become, as an industry,
it's not
like
regulated
said,
enough.
Exactly. Yeah. Started out as a cottage industry, needs to mature a little bit and become a little more sophisticated and professional. And so it sounds as though things that you're doing at ISBA, for example, are helping to bring that process along, you know, trying to develop some sort of standards and protocols for the ways in which influencers ought to be engaged. But I would really be interested to know what the sort of DTC brand perspective is on this, because we know from the DTC brand that we've chatted to, that we've maybe had on our podcasts or at some of our events, and particularly that we connect with through our DTC Daily title, you know, heavily rely on social networks for
scale.
Yeah, for scale, absolutely. And are really sort of dedicated to this, you know, to this notion of making those networks work as well as they possibly can for them. So they depend a lot on Instagram. They no doubt engage influencers. And, you know, conversations that we had with them did talk specifically about fatigue through Instagram, that they can't kind of cut through the noise and get their products seen or heard and get their, even just get their kind of content voices out there because it's so littered. So I just wonder what the, you know, what the DTC brand perspective is on this. Do you, get any feedback on that front?
I'd say probably limited feedback. I mean, clearly they're, you know, as you said, to get cut through, they're incredibly important for social, you know, social platforms.
Yeah.
In terms of actually, I mean, certainly, as you cited earlier on, the more clearly, the more prevalent, the bigger the platform was, the more competition there is, and the more difficult it is to kind of get cut through. And I don't know whether Instagram is considering addressing that in the same way that they did with the Facebook feed in terms of the content people receive.
Yeah.
And the way that they, and the way that's optimized around that to try and, you know, and that was a challenge for some businesses, but allows, it means that those that do get through, it's in a less cluttered atmosphere. So, but I don't know whether or not Instagram plans to do that. I mean, we've got a town hall actually with Instagram and Facebook next week, so
maybe that might be an opportunity to ask
them about that, because clearly if these figures, you know, which I think came from a TechCrunch story you know, I mean, eight times cheaper clearly, and as you said, it's, you know, it's about conversion here, so it might be eight times cheaper, does it converse as well? But saying that's a huge difference and a huge gap.
Well, it is. And if budgets start flowing there, then you know, that's going to be an issue for Instagram, right? So if they start flowing towards another platform, that's when they're definitely going to care. But I bet I'd be surprised if they weren't. So I'd be really interested, actually. Yeah. You must let us know, Steve, in the outcome of that at the town hall. Pose that question to them, because, you know, it can't – it's, they've got to be aware of the fact that that you know, that a lot of their revenue has kind of boomed as a result of just everybody being present on the platform, and there's almost always going to be some challenges to that along the way. They must be looking to refine their platform and their product as much as they possibly can. Yeah. I can't imagine that they're not.
No, and they're very good at that, aren't they? You know, in terms of when their stories became a big new format, they were very quick, you know, very quick to pivot on that.
Absolutely.
On the back of it. So, it, you know, they are quick to innovate, and I'm sure that they won't just with the – certainly with the release and with, you know, with Snap doing what they're doing, I'm sure that, you know, Instagram won't sit still.
No, absolutely not. Okay, so wanted to move on to our second news story of the week, which is focusing on streaming wars. I feel like we've you know, streaming wars is a sort of slightly ongoing conversation just because there's something in the news every other day lately, right?
Yeah.
So I'm hinging this particular discussion point onto Netflix releasing their Q3 numbers, I think, late last week, showing a continued slowing in subscriber growth. Although revenue has actually increased, and they managed to achieve revenue growth beyond what was anticipated from Wall Street analysts. So obviously that's the good news side of the story. What's interesting though about that growth is it's mostly coming from their international business and not their US business. And although their US subscriber figures didn't dip this quarter, they did the quarter before, they've not gone up as much as they wanted them to. So they missed the target on how much they wanted to increase those user numbers. So that's sort of the Netflix sort of picture. Pause on that for a moment and consider the fact that Amazon released some news this week that they're launching an ad-supported news video app for Fire TV. Obviously, sort of, you know, direct relevant potential competition there for Apple News Plus and Google News. But what's interesting about this is that they're releasing it in a sort of video environment. So that's sort of starting to add a little bit more, I suppose, of a sort of tangent to the streaming wars. We're not just talking about original content based on, you know, documentaries, fact and fiction, but also news services as well. So that's really interesting. And then the third thing I wanted to sort of hinge to this topic of conversation was a bit more of a detailed article that appeared on Forbes earlier on this week, talking about what Netflix's sort of financial position is, and where they potentially see the business going, particularly given their subscriber growth or lack thereof. They talked about the amount of money that Netflix is borrowing to continue to produce content, which is significant, very significant, and the rate at which they're expected to burn through cash as a result of that. So I guess this is a general conversation about streaming wars, about Netflix position specifically, and about where we're going to see the sort of advertising opportunity within streaming services. Lot to cover there. Steve, do you want to kick off?
Let's go about it. I think really interesting. I think, you know, Netflix's approach has, you know, it's just been about growth, isn't it? You know, it's been about growth and subscribers. And ultimately they were going to start to level off in their, you know, clearly in the US markets and developed markets. And like most, you know, multinational businesses of that size, the growth is going to be in the international. So I don't think that's a surprise. I don't think from certainly the engagement we've had with Netflix that they are anticipating moving to an ad-funded model. I mean, clearly there's product placement and other forms of advertising which may be considered, which isn't, you know, it isn't simply pre-roll or mid-roll advertising or just having any form of, you know, so it's not as crude as that. So there may be some form of, and again, we already see that, you know, some form of sponsorship sort of bleeding into streaming services. But I don't think Netflix are going to move anytime soon into ads. You know, they're still about growth.
Not even in international markets?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a point of separation. I think it's, you know, it's all about scale, and it's all about scale and a very cheap product. And ultimately, it's about the content, and so that obviously drives their approach to borrowing and spending what, $9 billion plus in terms of content.
Yep.
You know, which is just in terms of, you know, it's very difficult for national broadcasters in markets to compete with that. So still, in terms of the quality of the content, it will attract users at a price point that's very good. I mean, I know they put the price up, I think was it 12-18 months ago, by a pound, but it's still what, $7.99 a month. So to get that, so still very good. It's not to say the, you know, Amazon's proposition and others isn't, but with Prime it's packaged in obviously with a much bigger proposition in terms of delivery rather than being separated. So, you know, and you can sign up and cut the cord, you know, accordingly. It's really easy to do, so that flexibility and price point, it's still really attractive, but ultimately it's the content. And so I think that they're you know, they seem to be headed for just a continual growth strategy, if that means, you know, making very little in the way of profit or break even or even cost in some markets. I think they're willing to do so. And I don't, there isn't necessarily anybody, well, there is the emergence of Disney Plus. We'll see what happens there. And so we're just going to see these hubs of content and just see where consumers make the choice. Is it good enough? Is it enough for consumers to put their hands into their pockets and dig out another £5 or £10 a month to sign up to Disney Plus or, you know, or Apple, or looking at emerging, you know, American only platforms with, you know, looking at, I think NBC Universal, you know, looking at launching their own product as well. So it's a cluttered market, but ultimately I think we'll see the emergence of consumers frustrated they can't get some content. So already that's emerging anyway, I think, it's
absolutely
research.
People kind of what was the word that we were talking about, Lindsay, was it TVOD, transactional?
Yes, TVOD.
Yeah, but we were thinking about that in the context of TV streaming, that actually you're starting to see now people skipping between platforms in order to catch particular content. So signing up either for a free trial or not, or maybe just even on a one-off basis just to catch a piece of content. So I guess what we could say, added to what you've already said about, you know, about your opinion of when Netflix is going to continue to go with their business model, there's plenty of other sort of subscription services that they could be experimenting with as well, which could be those one-off pieces. You know, if they find that the monthly subscriptions wane after a while, or that people sign up for a period of time and then let it slip, then maybe it's a one-off transaction fee. I suppose there's lots of potential opportunities there and lots of potential alternative models that they could be looking at. And also, there's a bit of a difference here, isn't there, in between what we're talking about in terms of the US sort of streaming options compared with the UK streaming options and compared with activity everywhere else, right? Like you said, there is a plethora of options available to the consumer in the US to the extent that I cannot believe that everybody's going for everything. You know, people are definitely making a choice, right? Here in the UK, we've also got quite a lot of options, but it's less again, right? And so you tend to run at least two, maybe even three concurrently because there's certain content that you want to catch.
Exactly.
It'll just be interesting to see how that plays out in the long term and in other international markets. Lindsay, what's your point of view here?
Yeah, I mean, I think like touching on your US point, the US is completely different. And the amount that your average consumer would or would have paid for cable is far, far greater than what they would pay in the UK for the likes of Sky. Yeah. So the emergence of these skinny bundles that everyone talks about in the US, which almost literally the world and his wife has bought out in some form or another, where you pay anything between $4 and $20. If you had five of those, you're still probably only paying half what you were paying when you were actually paying for full cable. So the people still think of it as a massive opportunity to be able to launch more skinny bundles. But then you do have this, some TV shows are licensed across multiple platforms. So you are like, well, which one do I, we don't really have that in the UK yet. You can normally only get a TV show in one place. You can't get it on Netflix and Prime and on Now TV. Generally, one of them has a license to it, so we haven't got this yet. So everyone knows what where they're going to get their different content.
And which is why they tend to run two, maybe even three subscriptions.
Yeah. In the US, I mean, I often say subscription blindness because I believe everybody must have it, not have a clue what they're paying for or a clue where to find anything.
Or a clue how much of what they're paying for is covered in the exact same subscription they've got for something
else. Well, exactly, because Verizon have just announced in the US they're doing a deal with Disney. Oh, my brother's calling me. Hi there.
Verizon is busy at the moment.
His face has appeared on the TV screen wearing a ridiculous top hat. There you go.
Hi, Dominic Roundtree.
She's famous.
She's doubling up as sound guy and podcast guest.
He's very dapper.
Call you back. He does look very dapper.
That's his work uniform. Nice. Yeah, absolutely. He's going to hate me for this. I'm going to make sure he's into it.
Instantly famous, Dom Roundtree.
Brilliant. I forgot what I was going to say.
we were talking about... you were saying Disney, I think you were just
saying Verizon have just announced that they will be offering Disney Plus, which is launching very soon, for free for their customers for a year.
Oh, really?
Which I think is interesting. Really interesting. And it, you know, I don't know what the deal it looks like financially for either of those companies, but it does mean that Disney will have guaranteed subscribers, year-long subscribers, through all Verizon customers.
Shrewd.
And you're seeing it with Vodafone, so I get my Spotify for free. Well, free, I'm using air quotes here, through Vodafone. They also offer a Now TV bundle as well if you want that. Yeah. So my network bundle is very, very small. And it means that if I were to dip in and out of Spotify, I now don't bother because I know that with Vodafone, it's such a good deal. And again, I'm not sure what the financial deal is there. But I think you might start to see more and more of that. As Rachel, you talked about the jumping around that people do and they might go and get a half-price Now TV subscription for a month so they can watch Game of Thrones and then dump it as soon as they're done. We're seeing a lot more of that. Actually, with these tie-ins with your network providers, it does mean you're getting static subscribers for a year and probably static, probably consistent money through those financial deals as well, which could end up being more than what you get from people jumping around. But I think also you talking about, Steve, like Netflix not going ad funded. I mean, I think you're right. Like I don't think they're there yet. Everyone thinks they should and everyone thinks they will do soon, but they're so focused on trying to eke out every single last bit of juice of all their subscribers. So having two different tiers, one if it's just you watching and one if you want multiple people to watch. Yeah. They've just come out saying they're going to actually start really clamping down on people that have multiple people watching it in different households. Yeah. So if they do start clamping down that will then make people have to pay more and buy more subscriptions than currently exist. So there's and obviously the product placements like Coca-Cola and Stranger Things, like nobody could ignore that. Despite the fact that I don't think you can advertise Coca-Cola in this country on terrestrial TV, but never mind.
Interesting.
Different global deal, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But you do have all these things that Netflix are trying to push that first without going ad-funded. What I find interesting, I'm going on a massive tangent here, what I find interesting about Amazon is that Amazon aren't trying to stick ads into the TV shows and the films you're watching. They're creating a brand new channel full of news content and a lot of different news publishers are going to be working with them on it. And that's a great way for them to be able to get additional revenue through ad funding without then having to stick ads and insert ads into box sets. And that, I think, is something that is interesting approach to them going ad-funded.
And that's what's interesting, right, about Netflix is that they haven't experimented with that notion either, that actually they could run a couple of different sort of channels, if you like, within Netflix, which is, I suppose, a bit like the Spotify idea. Yeah. There's the Spotify ad-funded model and then there's the Spotify subscription version. Mm. And I know everyone thinks Netflix will never go to an ad-funded model, but I think the thing that could make them seriously consider it is expansion in Asia.
Yeah.
Because we know, certainly in Southeast Asia, that people do not have the money to devote to subscribing for streaming for streams content. And already the sort of incumbent version of Netflix in APAC, which is iFlix, tried a subscription model and had, you know, very limited success. So they're now going forward, pushing forward with an ad-funded model as well, right? So they're operating both. And I just think if Netflix are wanting to really get a stranglehold on the marketplace in that region, so that particular example was focusing on Southeast Asia, but there's also obviously North Asia, India, those sorts of environments where they would be up against a lot of other routine broadcast channels that have also got sort of catch up and streaming services as well. They've got to get very competitive in that environment. Yeah. And you're talking about an entire population of people across some of those Asian regions who will be consuming everything on a mobile device, who won't have the money to devote to subscription services. So why wouldn't you launch an ad-funded model in that region?
Yeah.
They're so used to it as well. Yeah. And like iFlix, which is a competitor for Netflix in Southeast Asia, they've launched ad-funded.
Yes, so I just said that, Lindsay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was listening. You did actually just say that.
Well, wow. It's okay. You're also doubling up as sound guy. And I'm having a little conversation with Dom Roundtree on the side
loud.
There.
You're being too loud. I'm trying to turn you down. Sorry. I'm going to turn you right down now and put you on mute.
Just a snapping Dom just in between.
Absolutely.
I think Netflix is, clearly the promise has been it's not ad-funded. I mean, you can never say never, but if it then did move to an ad-funded model, depending on the nature of that, would Netflix users feel betrayed by that?
Mm.
And would they therefore migrate away? But as you said,
I don't know how much they care, though, Steve. I mean, I reckon some do, but others, think about a younger generation as well. So think about that younger generation of people who won't even know what a TV is because they've only ever consumed TV content on a laptop or a handheld device or whatever. They won't care so much about the brand association,
that's true.
I don't think.
No, that's true.
I wasn't listening. What did you say?
I'm trying not to be loud. No. The reason you couldn't hear me, that's why.
Yeah, you make a very good point. You know, I sat here as feeling like a 43-year-old old fart. It's just not really speaking for the masses.
Connect with the youngsters. That's what you need to do there, Steve. Yeah, no, look, I totally understand. I know Netflix don't want to go ad-funded. Mm. But anyway, we are off on a tangent. One final question I wanted to ask on this as well is, what are the advertiser implications here? So I'd imagine advertisers would flock to something like Amazon News TV in a heartbeat. Mm. Great. You know, it's arguably a sort of quite engaging content format, easy to stick ads in an environment where you're not necessarily disrupting the viewer experience.
Yeah, I mean, there are challenges already, you know, sort of movement of linear audiences, you know, to catch up, you know, and Sky in itself has got a strategy of moving people to catch up, you know, that presents a problem in linear, and that clearly your audiences are moving up, price goes up. So we've seen double-digit growth in some areas, you know, and just inflation with declining audiences. That's a big issue already at the moment, more of a challenge already exists. And I guess the question then is, you know, will that continue? That fragmentation of audiences, clearly you need to understand they have trusted measurement. So clearly Netflix are fairly private about their user numbers. I mean, Nielsen, amongst other measurement providers, are now providing measurement of Netflix and other streaming services down to the program level. And that's really important for advertisers to, you know, to clearly know where the audiences are going. Yeah. And have robust, independent forms of measurement as opposed to trying to piece together the landscape. And there are good moves afoot, which we, you know, won't have time to go through today in immense detail about, you know, global movement towards more aligned measurements in terms of trying to find globally derived principles which try and bring together audience measurement across different channels. And streaming is going to have to be part of that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that unmeasured at the moment within the UK. So, you know, it's been a challenge that unmeasured audiences on streaming services and in other markets as well. And that ability to be able to measure that through existing measurement services and currencies. And that's been a big problem as well. So movement already of audiences, and that's creating increase in linear. And then not knowing where those audiences are going because, you know, those user figures are not known. So clearly advertisers want to gravitate towards, you know, those.
Where the users are.
But does it mean declining opportunities, you know, sponsorship opportunities and advertising opportunities against, you know, premium content and prime time that's moving to other platforms. That is a, you know, it's definitely a concern, not only from price, but clearly needing to reach consumers.
Yeah. It's a whole other can of worms, actually. Yeah. And one that we probably don't have time to discuss in more detail, unfortunately. Let's move on to the third news story of the week, which is a fairly detailed article that appeared on DigiDay this week, written by Seb.
Seb Joseph. I was looking at some Olympic related on YouTube this morning. So just made up my mind.
Well, certainly
there will be diversification.
Certainly, Olympic standard journalist, I would say, Seb. Yeah. He's a good friend of Exchange
Wise. Nice link. Good. Yeah. Excellent.
Seb's very good detailed article, very interesting detailed article on agency rebates that appeared on DigiDay, I think, late last week. So he goes into a little bit of detail, quoting some a couple of sources and speaking specifically with Ubiquiti, who are obviously tasked with running all sorts of auditing reports into agency activity, on where we're at in terms of the rebate landscape. This is a huge issue, obviously, for trust and transparency between brands and agencies. And what we've got is Ubiquiti coming out saying that they don't really feel that an awful lot has changed, actually, and that where there are more transparent contracts now in place and there's a standard for those contracts between brands and agencies, what we're seeing is that there's still quite a lot of other techniques and tactics that are used that would fall under the sort of umbrella of rebate arrangements. So that's things like free ad space from inventory that's gained via the media owner and then sold onto the brands, and other forms of markups which are just being used to sort of maximise agency profits. So he paints very much a picture of brands still being somewhat in the dark in with regards to what their agencies are up to. And obviously the picture is going to be different depending on which agencies we're talking about and, you know, I suppose the size of the relationship between the brand and the agency. But it begs the question, where are we at in the industry in terms of trust and transparency between agencies and brands? What is this saying about the sort of service layer proposition that agencies are offering brands? You know, we know that brands are demanding that that's not just more transparent, but also a little more nuanced and sophisticated. Are we still looking at an agency landscape where agencies are still so concerned about their bottom line sort of profits that they're not actually closely enough adhered to brands' goals in terms of what they want to strategically achieve through their advertising budgets? And is this saying something about how much we're still in an environment where agency business models need to change? I don't think anyone would argue that agencies need to be appropriately remunerated for their work, but it ought not to be in a way that brands don't understand what they're paying for. So, yeah, I'm sure you've got a lot to say about this, Steve. What's your perspective on this?
Yeah, so I get, you know, if that story is substantiated, clearly that's concerning about the using free inventory and free media and marking it up, you know, and actually using it, so essentially monetizing free inventory. I mean, it's all the movement of rebates, and if it's true, that's sort of shifting. So rather than, you know, declaring money back, which then has to be declared in the audit, then shifting it to inventory, which is free, and then pushing that back as part of the plan. I guess the question is, I think in the story it talked about, you know, is it more of an ethical issue here? And I think that's probably more spot on. I mean, we've seen a difference between the US and the UK, notably in that agencies in the UK trade as principals. So you as the client trade with the agency, and the agency then has its own supply chain. In America, they trade as agents. So the investigation that's obviously rolled on, that's now led to the FBI still continuing its investigation.
Yeah.
You know, the agencies are agents to those clients. So the two markets are different. So where there's similarities. So I think a lot of what we see in terms of, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around agencies rebates clearly, and, you know, and actually having sort of group deals, and are they fully aligned to the interests of the clients? The markets are different. So it's not to say there aren't some commonalities, but I think importantly from a legal perspective, there are differences.
Yep.
I think 3 years on from the Casey report that the ANA published, clearly there were some, you know, disturbing findings in that. And at the same time, we released a framework contract to work. So a framework to advise agencies and clients how they should contract with their agencies and the sort of things, you know, what they should broker in their deals and more advice. It wasn't necessarily a lift to cut and paste. It was advisory terms. And it pointed out and it looked clear, very clearly at rebates and return of value back to clients. And we updated it last year and then we'll look at future iterations as well. So, you know, we would always encourage clients clearly to, you know, to move to terms that are fully aligned, clearly meet their objectives and for the agency and client to be fully aligned. That places a requirement also on clients, and that's an important point as well. We're talking about, you know, the fee margins need to be correct. You know, we're not in the space at the moment, this is bar saying this is the perfect fee margin, but it needs to be a way, as you pointed out, that fairly remunerates the agency. But we're seeing fee margins that are desperately low in some cases, perhaps at 1%. Mm. So the agency is going and seeking its margin in its supply chain, which leads to, you know, buying behaviours which aren't potentially in the interest of the clients. It leads to procurement of media which isn't necessarily of the best quality sometimes. And it's about trying to transition clients and agencies to new ways of working. So we've seen that with the government, the way that they repitched their contract. We worked with them on that. And they said, well, look, you know, clearly price is a factor, but look at value. What's value? You know, and they're very specific in that they use the public purse. Mm. So what are the things that they need insurance against, which needs that need to be met in the way that media is bought using the public purse? They set very specific criteria. They went in and made it very clear with all six agency groups. And there was also an independent also going for it. It was Truth Agency.
Right.
That ran. And they all went into pitch with it, knowing that actually you weren't going to get surprised with the pricing grid further down the line. And that was good and that's great. And they were able to broker an agreement and eventually they decided to shift agencies and decide that the agency they chose, the MG, that actually they could align to their objectives. And they were very clear about the, you know, essentially what they're thinking behind that. Barclays have done the same. And, you know, we're trying to showcase those to actually say to people, like, you know, you can make sure that clearly you want to work with trusted agency partners. But some of those fee margins are so low sometimes that, and the agency doesn't have to take it. You know, if they take a low fee margin, you know, what happens then to its other stable of clients? You know, what does it mean there in terms of, you know, if they're seeking margin, are they seeking margin from the supply chain? Does it mean that there are, you know, clearly differences in fee margins amongst their clients? How does that affect their other clients? A lot of questions there. But we have clients, procurement, clearly who are very well informed, who are working, you know, intensively with their, you know, with their agency partners to broker appropriate agreements. But sometimes, you know, there may be, again, we know with some fee margins, they're too low and therefore it drives certain behaviours. Mm. So it's trying to then bring parties, you know, procurement, marketing and agencies together on a journey to try and say, OK, what do you need to achieve as clients and what relationship, you know, what deal structure would allow you to deliver that allows both to be fully aligned as opposed to, you know, using kind of grouped behaviour, very low margins of, you know, a lot of, you know, using a pot of cash from a lot of clients and using it in a way, you know, actually then expressing your buying power. How do you then, and then returning that value fairly between those parties? Mm. You know, how can you do that in a way that's, you know, you don't lose sight of the client's objectives? Okay. So I think to answer the original question, there is this, you know, still on the journey to sort of move clients and agencies to those more sustainable relationships. But there's no doubt that some agencies are more leveraged on the high volume, low margin business than others. And that presents a problem as they try and transition away from their existing models to more progressive models that are sustainable to them as well.
Yeah, lots to say about that. But Lindsay, I want to go over to you because, of course, you've got some experience of the agency landscape, having worked for an agency beforehand. Before Exchange Wire.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to admit that anything existed in your life before Exchange Wire, but you know,
I totally get it. Yeah,
before being a sound person.
Yeah, before being sound guy,
really pretty bad one as well. Yeah, frankly.
Is this sounding like very familiar territory? Have things changed?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question to you, Steve, is how in all my time that I've been in media, which arguably isn't that long versus some people, and kind of what I saw from when I started agencies to the conversations we're having now, like we're still seeing 1% fees is absolutely crazy. Like, do you see, and obviously there have been reports, there's been scandals over the past few years, but nothing really seems to be moving on from 10 years ago to today.
I think you are seeing some clients who are doing that. Clearly, as we said, the government, Barclays, Sky didn't move its business, but it, you know, repitched out its business and set new terms. There are clients doing that, the more progressive clients, and clearly those that have procurement specialists as well. I know that agencies, not saying demonised, but they, you know, they find sometimes dealing with procurement challenging in terms of granular.
I mean, you're being very diplomatic. Feel free to say agencies hate procurement teams because they do.
And it's
Lindsay said it for you.
Yeah.
But having specialist procurement, you know, we've got one particular member who's his procurement team are there to procure goods in their supply chain, who also do media.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a real challenge for them, and it's not isolated, which procurement in general, and depending on your field of expertise and whatever your supply chain, your products is, that's really difficult. I think what certainly worth focusing on is making sure the procurement, marketing, and agency community are really fully aligned for, you know, and again,
much more closely aligned. Yeah.
That is changing. I can see that. The number of people you're saying that actually now have media procurement roles rather than just being people that work in procurement, that have a limited understanding of what media is and how they should be buying and trading.
Exactly.
There definitely is a change in that, I'm noticing.
Exactly. And actually, we've hired in, Debbie Morrison, who used to lead what I was called a consultancy team at Isbarn, she went to Ubiquity. We've just hired a new chap called Andrew Loudon, and Andrew comes from that. Comes from that world.
Media procurement.
Really understands his potatoes and actually being able to bring that client experience and help to work with members, you know, in terms of advising members and actually trying to advise how they work with their agency. So that's, you know, and his role is no longer isolated. There were many more media procurement specialists, and long may it live. I think it's a really good thing to have. I think that it's, the question is, and I guess to answer your original question, is them, and it's difficult to say what proportion and where are clients in that spectrum, clients and agencies, and how leveraged. I mean, I think it's quite obvious, you can see from certain groups and agencies, you can see, you know, there's certain notable ones that are more leveraged, I think, in terms of high volume, low margin. There are others offering more, you know, dare I use the T word because it's loaded, but transparent, you know, sort of models. So, you know, sort of the emergent essence, really interesting. Again, with Omnicom, some of its business, the way it's setting terms with clients, you know, and again, in a more open and transparent model, in a way that gives clients full audit rights, which is really important. But trying to, for those agency businesses, then it doesn't mean to say they've got to move entirely to another model, but having that, being able to transition based on clients' needs to different models is going to be gradual.
Yeah.
When we've been working with the IPA with agency CEOs, marketing directors and CMOs and procurement directors at trying to look at what a sustainable relationship looks like. And there was a good pitch guide sort of republished a few weeks ago between the IPA and Isbarn. That was a great piece of work on that. And we'll see what else we can look at and, you know, develop there as well. But, you know, having that conversation between those parties, saying actually, you know, what does a progressive relationship look like? It's not just all about trying to go to the pitch and what a good pitch looks like, but what does a good relationship look like month on month, year on year, you know, essentially how do we, you know, and a realization, understanding what a good relationship looks like.
That sounds like a really big, very important piece of work.
So that's really important, isn't it? And clearly, but there are going to be times also where there's the you know, we're not always going to agree, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fine, but it's...
Well, it's to be expected in a business context, isn't it? But yeah. I guess it's about establishing some sort of, you know, ring fencing around what is good practice and what isn't good practice.
Exactly.
And trying to get everybody to agree to at least those principles.
Yeah. And you absolutely, from an agency perspective, you can't have a one-size-fits-all approach. No. And even if you decide that, you know, actually maybe FTE is a better option than going up percentage commission, percentage fee, even then there are certain agencies that will say, yes, we'll put this one person on as 100% FTE on this client, and then that person's working on four different clients at 25% FTE. So because agencies have their own targets. Their targets are, need to make this percentage of media traded digital. We need to increase billings, increase clients, increase profit margin. We need to make sure that you know, there's so many different things, and those things in and of themselves don't actually agree with each other. So how can you do one and do the other while knowing that by doing one, the other will reduce? And that's what agencies are trying to battle with. And that's why you see, you know, some of them look like they're being managed like hedge funds. It's kind of because they are being managed like hedge funds.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and it's a challenge. But at the end of the day, the clients want to work with the best talent, and they're prepared, you know, and they're prepared to pay for that. The question then is, can they?
As they should be.
Yeah, and there are models that allow for that. You know, it's so clearly the clients need to be able to understand, you know, and understand the value of that talent and what the agency is offering. My own personal view is that my wife is a management consultant, and it's interesting that a lot of management consultancies charge for strategy and implementation. Often is where they don't make the margin in implementation. Some do, but very few do. They make most of the money in strategy projects. And the implementation might be part of their offering. It's not for some like McKinsey and others, but it's, you know, and it's added on to the project about making it come to life. But the value is put in strategy, and it's almost with media agencies, it's kind of upended. And I heard a media planner, a senior planner, talking the other day about essentially they feel that within the agencies, the power is going back more to the planning and the comms planning side, when they felt there's been a shift just to kind of the, you know, the buying end of the business. that actually they feel more of a shift internally and more value being put on planning and strategy as opposed to just the buying side. Because if your margins carved out of implementation, that's only going to go one way.
There's no margin implementation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why you see management consultancies are able to charge very healthy rates. And they're trusted partners. You're trying to put a value on strategy as opposed to implementation, but you can put and append real value to that implementation. It's only going to be with margins being carved out continually. And I think that shift from agencies are moving, and clearly clients be willing to accept more value on the strategy side, making more margin on that,
yep,
rather than implementation. So yep, that'll be the way to go.
That's really interesting. To what extent does the picture change a little bit dependent on the kind of size of the brand? So you talked a bit about, gave some really good examples about the government repitching, their business, and then also Barclays. But what about smaller brands? What sort of position do you feel that they're in when it comes to trying to make sure that they're getting the best value contractual arrangement out of their agency?
No, I think so.
Might not have procurement teams internally and so forth?
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good point. I guess the question for them is that if they decide to fly, to go solo and try an in-house, which is one route, it shouldn't be the reason you in-house. It's purely because you believe you're going to get, essentially because you're unhappy with your agency. That shouldn't be your only route. But it's a consideration for that is the concern about lack of buying power, but then within the agency itself, concerned about where they are in the pecking order.
Exactly.
But with any agency they work with, they should be able to then, clearly their account team, they should be able to look at the breakdown of utilization in their account teams at the agency, what service they offer, and the client should be able to assess, what's the headcount on their business? What do they do? How many hours do they spend to actually establish whether or not it's good enough for their, for them, what they want to achieve. But I think there's some smaller clients do feel there's a natural expectation they're going to be low down in the pecking order and therefore less important.
Mm.
But a concern if I insource that, I'm not only trying to source that talent and retain that talent and actually utilize it and the capital costs of bringing in-house, but also am I going to be able to get the kind of buying power or not? But clearly you'd have potentially more clarity about your margins, but what's the uptick in costs going to be? So concern around it, I think regardless of the size of the business you are, you should be able to ask for terms that align fully to you as a client.
Mm.
Clearly there's no, if you're a bigger account, you're going to expect more headcounts, more resource dedicated to you, but that doesn't mean to say that you should have more transparency the bigger the client you are and less transparency and sort of non-disclosed approach if you're a smaller client.
Absolutely.
It has to change. It has to be agnostic of that.
Yeah. And just picking up as well on your point about sort of strategy versus implementation and delivery, it seems to me that that's where agencies can really offer some value to the whole sort of suite of, challenger brands, digital brands, DTC brands who are often doing things on their own, right? Because, firstly, they might not have big budgets and firstly, they're looking at spend in a completely different way and they're looking at channels in a different way. But, agencies have got a lot of expertise to offer, right? That's the thing that we constantly come back to when we have this conversation about the relationship between brands and agencies and also about, fees and remuneration and so forth. So, it seems that maybe that's a job for agencies to do to sell themselves in as, strategic specialists, perhaps to some brands that won't necessarily think of going directly to a media agency to get all their media buying done.
And I think I think with every agency I've spoken to, they've considered themselves to be a strategic partner. Mm. I guess the question then is, depending on how their business structure, does it afford them the opportunity to be that?
Mm.
Because clearly they're under revenue pressures in many cases, and clearly more, but the pitch cycle for businesses is getting, is getting shorter and shorter, that ability to kind of push out to pitch, and that presents a challenge.
Mm.
We've, as part of that working relationship, working with the IPA, working with agency CEOs and marketing directors and procurement directors, actually having an understanding, it's been discussed as understanding what it costs to go to pitch, go to pitch if it works for you. And again, it's the right time, but don't necessarily let it get to that point where you're so frustrated, you just think, I have to go to pitch. How can you make the best out of your agency relationship, which I think is the right way to go. But the agency structure and the way that, does it afford in terms of headcount and time, does it afford you to spend enough time strategically? But also the client needs to be very clear on its terms, and depending on the nature of the brand, if it's a DCC brand in a very aggressive marketplace, the ability to turn around quickly and the need to compete quickly may dictate. You may not have the luxury of a long brief, and that brief might be incredibly short and just needing to go to market as soon as possible. So it depends also, I think, on the brand itself. It depends if it affords you that ability to be able to match your strategic thinking and spend the time beefing. But we'll, let's see where it goes. I think it's important that clients are offered the opportunity and agencies are willing to move their models and then see how a, you know, clients transition. My own personal view, not ISBAR's, is I think that non-disclose in the long term, I think has to increasingly go away personally as well. I think that, you know, right through the supply chain, you know, we see it, you know, particularly still rife and programmatic of having, you know, the old network model, which has now been repackaged, and the idea of just that, you know, of kind of trust with limited verify. So it's not trust and fully verify, it's trying to trust and limited verify and saying, trust us, we'll deliver to the audiences. And it's, you should understand that everybody should be open to where the provenance of what you're buying, the reason you're buying that, the audiences you're reaching, does it match the client's expectations? Does the client, the client's got to fairly remunerate the agency as well, but there should be full alignment through that supply chain. And there just isn't at the moment, you know, possibly through the way that structures and contract structures in place at the moment. But I don't think that non-disclosure approach in the very long term, I don't think it can be sustained. Some might argue that, you know, for smaller emerging brands, it has to be because it's cheaper. But, you know, there's no reason why they should, you know, why there should be non-disclosure going through in the long term. It's not, I think that that, personally, I said my own personal view, not as buzz as that ship has sailed, I think.
Yeah.
Increasingly, but it can't just go overnight.
Yeah, no. And it's, clearly, it's a bit of a journey, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and clearly, but some, we know that some brands are in a position where just because of, and again, it's a realisation of market pressures. You know, we had one brand recently, it just had to make 20% cutting costs, just 20% overnight. You know, that led to then consolidation from two agencies into one because one could sustain that. And because of where they were domiciled, it meant that they could absorb the cost. The other one was a London agency and they couldn't. So, you know, there's just some economic pressures which clients are under. And, it's, you know, the clients aren't at fault. It's just the economic pressure they're under. So I think there has to be a realisation that particularly where we're headed in, you know, now over the next few weeks, which is...
economic uncertainty central, as if we haven't been there for the last 3 years anyway.
Exactly,
but yet
which is just ongoing.
Still sort of, crescendo.
Exactly, Lisa says, as well as obviously having emerging brands, you know, again, DCC brands and challenger brands, and that presenting a problem for, and presenting more of a challenge for established brands, economic uncertainty and the need for, you know, for brands and for businesses to control costs. That's going to create challenge, and maybe that's creating, you know, maybe that's why we're not seeing a smoother transition to your point about way, you know, about moving away from to more open and aligned models.
Yeah.
And why we still see that sort of dragging of existing models at the moment, which aren't necessarily in the interest of clients.
Yeah. I feel we've, as ever, veered into second half of the podcast territory already. Everything okay over there, sound guy?
Yeah, I just hit the headphones with my hand and it made a massive echoing sound.
Oh,
so,
okay.
shock of my life there. Sorry.
It's got like being having neck cracked by a chiropractor. And anybody can just hear a small click in you.
Which but I, to was, you, it to feels you, like someone just world. Ripped your neck off your shoulders.
Which is a really embarrassing moment, actually, in my life when I was, because I went to a chiropractor because I'm just spare time rower. And so you get misaligned backs. So they had a chiropractor at our gym just saying, and they would sort of just want, you know, they knew there were a few rowers in the vicinity. So they said, come and get aligned for a couple of sessions for free. And they had this treatment room and they had three people in the room together. So they were able to offer it cheaply because you went in a private room. They manipulated someone and they moved on to the next person because they kind of let you rest. And the first time they did my neck and they cracked my neck, I jacknuffed in the middle and shouted, crikey! In the middle of it. My head practically touched my toes. And then there was a stunned silence. Because I think anybody can advocate this. When they crack your neck for the first time, it feels and sounds like your neck's broken.
Yeah.
I don't think I shouted crikey, to be honest.
I was about to say, that's extremely admirable that that's all you shouted.
I did not say crikey.
Yeah. It was a bit lame and also embarrassing.
The room would turn blue if that happened to me.
Yeah.
And I'm also quite glad that you didn't shout crikey really loudly just then with your headphones incident. So
I would have deafened myself as well.
Everybody else. What was I saying? Second part of the podcast, focusing on what ISBA, what you're working on at ISBA at the moment. I think we've probably talked about quite a lot of really good stuff
anyway.
This is a long
episode, by the way, guys.
So we'll try.
It's very interesting, though.
Speed this bit up. You helpfully, as prep for the podcast, gave us a list of some of the things you're working on at the moment. I suppose the thing I wanted to pick out of that and get you to talk about a little bit was the ICO, RTB and PECA report.
Yeah.
We talked about this on stage at ATS London in September because we had Ali Shah from the ICO come and talk to us a little bit.
Yes, really interesting session.
Yeah. And so I'm really interested in the ISBA perspective on where we're at with the RTB and PECA report updates. And I'm particularly interested in what work the ICO might have done with you sort of directly to try to get a bit of a sounding from the advertiser side of the industry.
Yeah, so I think dealing with that last point first, we met with the ICO and had a roundtable of advertisers in July.
Okay,
so good. That was, what, about 2 weeks after they published a report in mid-June during Cannes, to get the advertiser perspective. And really just to source, you know, to source feedback from, you know, to make sure that was 3 months in the offing, because we wanted to see them ever since they had notably to have an ongoing form of engagement. But when they had their ad tech forum in March, which I think some people were aware of, some people weren't, it was a closed doors private forum with about 120 people. And what manifested in that forum, and I think it was pointed to in the report, was the lack of engagement in some quarters of the industry. You know, the IAB has been strongly engaged with, on behalf of our tech providers, Google, Facebook and others, very strongly engaged advertisers through us and independently going directly to the ICA. But a lack, I think, from the ad tech sector, a lack of direct interface and contact. And what that's led to is the ICA. I don't think any of these, you know, the claims and assertions put forward we would disagree with, particularly in RTB and that lack of control around personal data. Mm. And more to the point, the individual knowing what data is being harvested and then which companies, that definitely needs to be addressed. But the narrative, there's been a bit of a gap. I mean, the IAB has been going directly to the ICA, and that's great, but actually hearing from ad tech companies and ISBAR and others have been encouraging businesses to go and speak to the ICA, particularly during that period between March and June and into July, because I think at the conference they said actually we're still want to engage with businesses, but actually they're more, you know, they've gone to drawing initial conclusions and they're going to be drawing next conclusions. And they're saying, look, if you disagree with what we found, come and speak to us. But we haven't got time to speak to
everybody
who just wants to engage in a casual cup of coffee. Mm. But what they didn't hear from were ad tech businesses. And if they did hear from them, they often heard from lawyers, which is great. And lawyers, lawyers, fantastic. And they're very, very supportive of business and commercial in-house lawyer. I think for anybody, it's really worth their salt. But, you know, in terms of operating the next level discussion around operational models, not commercial models, they tend to be clearly a risk-averse audience. They're going to be limited in what they can say. But operationally, they're not going to be able to describe to the ICA and actually say, you know what, that's your assertion, this is reality. And we know that with the IAB and others, they have working groups looking to address that, the AOP as well. We're doing some really interesting work at the moment and providing a view of actually what happens and see how that compares and putting forward potentially... and we'll see whether or not there's any form of reform that's recommended, because I think we're definitely in the vein of having to reform. Mm. We can't be in the space of just trust where we are at the moment with a few tweaks and with a few sort of tightening of the kind of nuts and bolts, keep things the same. You know, it doesn't mean the end of programmatic, clearly, but for RTB, there's definitely some changes and challenges about how do you inform the consumer so they understand how the data is used. But that ability for platforms, regardless of whether they win the bid or not, to grab that data, they've got to be able to see the audience. But it needs to be done in an anonymous way, and whether it's cryptography or other means of doing that, there are emerging sources and emerging players who allow the ability to kind of reach audiences, but without data being transferred to the cloud and multiple parties. It allows people then to see audiences, but that data is not to be transferred either away from the device or away from the individual. And clearly there are browsers, some with who are offering services, and you know, in that sense, about keeping and processing on the device only. There are emerging businesses talking about then just processing, keeping it on the device. We'll see where Apple was updated ITP guidelines are, because that looks like it might kill that business. Mm. And there are others, emerging businesses that are looking at creating data silos so that nobody has a full... The data never moves away, but it's a way of matching audiences and matching individuals and clients with publisher audiences, but in a way where data never leaves the individual or the publisher. So publishers don't have to give away their audience data. It doesn't have to be stored by a third party. And the user's anonymity is preserved and the privacy is preserved. But those aren't, you know, we can't suddenly switch to that. But I don't think so in essence, we can't rely on future-facing models and saying it's coming, it's changing. We need to create change now. What does that mean for RTB? We don't necessarily know. You know, our role is to try and provide a risk assessment. It's not, you know, we want to work with industry partners to see what they suggest and whether change to existing schemas and change to existing models might be to replace that. But there's no doubt, I think the ICO is not minded just to say, we'll keep things as they are. And then when emerging tech emerges fully and has scale, then it's okay. And it's okay for the industry to have a 2-year buy by the time we transition to that. They want to see change now, and they're going to release their updated findings by the end of the year, and their next ad tech forum's mid-November. Mm. So let's see what they say at that forum.
Do you know who's attending that forum? Is it going to be a wider audience than the one in March?
That I don't know. Mm. I mean, I think the ICO sent out the invites to anybody that attended the first forum.
Yep.
Which is about 120 people.
Yep.
There needs to be more ad tech players in the
Indeed.
Room.
Indeed, that's why I ask. And it's interesting because, you know, both in the lead up to preparation for ATS London and sort of in general, our conversations with the ICO have centred on the fact that they do, you know, they've echoed exactly what you said. We want to connect more with the ad tech community. We don't have the resource to be connecting on an individual basis. They've approached us as Exchange Warren, so can you help us with that conversation? Great. To which we've said, absolutely. Mm. But unfortunately, engagement, I'm not trying to sort of, you know, publicly call people out, but I just wanted to have this conversation because it's really important. Yeah. I know a lot of our listeners will be interested in this. Engagement with them has been tricky since then because I think they're under the cosh. They just don't have the resource to attend to everything. We finally managed a bit of cut through and we've got, I think, something due to be set up between us and Simon McDougall.
This is Stephen in front of you.
There's just too many S names in the podcast today. Seb.
Co.
And so we do have something coming up, but I suppose what I'm conscious of is that the message was very much both in the update report and then on stage at ATS London, time is running out, ad tech. So, you know, you need to be engaged in this and you need to be evidencing that you're doing something about it now. So that's important. That's an important point that I think that's landed with everybody. I don't want us to be having a conversation with the ICO in sort of November when actually they're going to be releasing their next findings in December. So I'm just hoping, Ali, Simon, if you're listening to this, we're desperate to have a conversation with you a little more speedily than we have been today. And, and it also just makes me wonder, because what's important in this is that on the one hand, I understand how ad tech players are perhaps haven't necessarily been forthcoming in their discussions because I think they've been a bit confused themselves. They've also been very nervous about what is going to happen in terms of enforcement.
Understandably.
And now I think that picture has been clarified, which is that the ICO have definitely got a role to play and the power for enforcement, and they have every intention of bringing those powers forward if they feel people are being sort of willfully negligent of the letter of the law and of the sort of impetus behind the legislation. But they want to have an open conversation. I think ad tech vendors are willing to do that. We just need to create the platform for that to be possible.
I think so. I think we've got to keep in mind here, the ICO needs to look at the interest. It's looking at the interest of consumers and observing law and having to interpret that law. Mm. I think it's been said that, you know, it doesn't mean to say that the ICO has to administer that. It doesn't mean to say that personally that they have to align they have to stand by, clearly, GDPR and PECA and emerging e-privacy. It doesn't mean to say they have to agree with every aspect of it, but they have to administer it as it's written. And there is some ambiguity, clearly, and about applying that to different industries, not just our own. And there's going to be somewhat of a challenge there. There needs to be precedent in case law. And we're seeing now that, you know, a lot of the emerging case law that will come from the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. And the Irish DPA, and there are cases there in the next 3 to 6 months where we're probably going to see some outcomes from cases there that will set the tone. That those will be shared clearly at the European Data Protection Board of all the data protection authorities, including the ICO, if we still, I guess, remain in, you know, in Europe, and whether or not we continue to sit on that board, I guess, will determine where we are with Europe. And they will share, and there will hopefully be emerging consistent precedents being set, because I think another challenge is that some differences of interpretation by different DPAs around Europe.
Yeah.
So already with Canil in France and with the German DPA, we're seeing some differences of opinion, maybe not so much on RTB at the moment, because I think the ICO is very much leading on that. But with cookie law and cookie directive, some are looking towards the horizon of e-privacy and what's likely to come. The ICO is very much looking at PECA as it is now. We use cookie law enshrined in our law with PECA. They're looking at that now, what's already, and then how to update that with the requirements of GDPR. Some, like Canil and others, are looking at what happens with e-privacy and the sort of where we're likely to transition to. And they've given until June next year, I think, for businesses to transition away and to look to potentially moving to opted-in consent for all cookies, including analytics, which again is a challenge for advertisers as part of the updated PECA cookie guidance. We're saying actually all analytics cookies are not essential and therefore they have to be fully opted in. I would say if you look across the majority of websites, regardless of who owns them, you're looking a lot, we found, they're all pre-ticked opt-ins, regardless of who they are. based on the existing guidance, the guidance released at the same 2 weeks after the RTB guidance, all that has to go away. That all has to be switched up by default. And then there's a requirement then within your privacy notice for you to be able to adequately and succinctly demonstrate what the value exchange is to the consumer and get their informed consent to opt in. And clearly there's a lot of concern that does it get switched off and how many people are meaningfully going to switch it on, not knowing what their data is used for, what purpose, what the value exchange is. And that's a challenge for us that we're working with, you know, working with the ICO on at the moment, so that analytics cookie is being switched off, because many use analytics to deliver the service in its raw, you know, to be able to look at actually maintaining, you know, your 404 broken link will be known that through analytics cookies, because suddenly your analytics drop off and you think, oh, there's a problem there. There's a problem on the site, and being able to monitor delivery on the site. For marketing purposes, it depends. You know, they're arguing that they're not essential, and clearly we have to work with that. But there are some elements of analytics which we definitely think are there, which are essential for delivering, you know, the quality, the service to the consumer. And that's a point of difference. But there is a variance of opinion across different DPAs. And that, I hope, you know, when they start sharing precedents and case law with each other, that will start to be ironed out. And we won't see those differences between different authorities. Yeah. But I think undoubtedly the ICO is, I believe, is the most well-staffed. You know, Simon and his team, I think, you know, again, fully staffed. I think they're looking at going from 700 to 750 people in the ICO.
Yeah.
You know, and clearly on RTB, they're the most progressive that we've seen in terms of actually then establishing a view on that. And they're not looking to, I think as they said at your conference, they're not looking to try and kill ad tech. They're looking at emerging tech, yeah, which could replace that. You, yeah, know? And I think that's interesting. And but people need to realise, you know, the cookies, it's the cookie, right, the advice around from the ICO is cookies and similar technologies. Mm-hmm. So this is the idea of moving to a cookieless world, and that will solve the problem. And having a persistent identifier, no real time to talk about that today, but that's a problem, because you're identifying the individual.
Yeah, exactly.
Therefore, it's not going to wash.
Exactly. There's so many issues wrapped up in this, but we've kind of run out of time, actually.
Or, been, in other words, gone way over time.
Okay, yeah. Yes, right, way over time.
Might need to take scissors so to perhaps the, it's editing,
a,
yeah.
Exactly. So perhaps it's an opportunity to follow up on some more of this in a bit more detail in another podcast.
Definitely.
Thank you very much, Steve, for coming in. That was a really interesting conversation. Appreciate it.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Sound Guy.
You're welcome, and you're welcome.
Well done. That was this week's MedTech Podcast.